My name's Ed Fulner, and as usual, the two biggest lies in the world are, number one, the check's in the mail. Number two, I'm from Washington. I'm here to help you. But hopefully today we will help you understand what's going on some of our major institutions and what our response can be, should be, has been. It's really a neat panel to be able to chair and to hear these differing perspectives. I was thinking earlier about the good old days of Ronald Reagan. Well, back early in the good old days of Ronald Reagan, they weren't completely good. We didn't even have a Federalist Society, Gene, until 82, 83, when Stanford, Chicago, Yale, and Harvard first got Federalist Society started. And you are now, I think, on every single accredited law school campus in the country. So you're the model to which we all aspire. Sally has been doing great work in terms of medical schools. We're going to hear what Mitch is trying to do with national security. And Marilyn has some very interesting insights in terms of what goes on in the business school. So my duty here, as everybody comes in, and we're happy to see you all, come on in, is to keep the trains running on time. I know what all the time limits are, and I know my panelists do as well. And at a certain point, we are going to have a timekeeper right up here in the front who will tell us that somebody is waxing too, if not too eloquently, too lengthily. So we will cut it off. We have hopefully a good 20 minutes for Q&A at the end. And so without any further ado, everybody, I think, has seen the bios of our speakers. I'm not going to talk about their wonderful credentials. You know what they are. You can look them up. Gene Meyer, kick it off.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thanks to the Philanthropy Roundtable for doing this panel. What I want to do is discuss what the Federal Society has done, stressing what might be duplicated in other areas. And, you know, whenever you're trying to copy something, it always has to be done with an awareness that each situation is different. But the core of many of these ideas are potentially transferable. And I start out with the principles we started out with, which was our view of the law was that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of powers is central to our constitutional structure, and it's emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it ought to be. Now, that was the extent, and is to this day the extent of our formal positions. Consider the situation for a law student entering law school 30 years ago, and Ed alluded to this a little bit, that there are some ways in which things are better, some ways in which things are worse. But at that stage, if you entered law school, the faculty was almost all on the left. The extracurricular groups in law school were almost all on the left. The dinner table conversation, the same. Classroom discussion, if somebody mentioned a point of sort of pro-free markets or pro-limited government, they would not get in class, they wouldn't get a very warm reception either from the professor or from the students. That was the atmosphere. Now we've had a situation where today, and for some years now, there's a significant change. So whereas 30 years ago, if you were on the left, you were encouraged in every way to be active in the public policy world. If you did not share those views, if you believed in limited government, if you were interested in free markets, you were encouraged essentially to shut up about your ideas. And being interested in a practical career, law, people, if they're encouraged to do something enough, will do it. They'll do it for 3 years of law school, and that will probably last a lifetime. Not only was that bad for those who shared a sort of Federal Society point of view, it was bad for all the students because nobody got the benefit of hearing differing positions. One of the starting points for us was as an organization not taking positions was beyond our broad statement of purpose. We got an interesting situation with a few years late, about 10 years ago, I got a call from a reporter who was puzzled by this. He said, well, gee, we just had a couple people who've been appointed to an administration and we're getting a little bit of visibility. And the guy said, congratulations, you're so important, you're doing so well, you're so influential. Yeah, okay. And then he said, okay, tell us what your position is on gun control. And I said, well, we don't take public policy positions. I said, well, I just told you. And he said, oh, that's interesting. Well, what's your position on Miranda rights? And after going through the same thing, he said, I see, okay, but surely, you have a position on abortion, don't you? And when I gave the same explanation, he said, but you've been so influential, you must take positions. Well, I think what I argue is the other way around. I think to some degree, one can be very effective not taking formal policy positions because ultimately, while Washington thinks everything's about power, ultimately, ideas play a critical role in whether an organization can be effective and whether good, smart, capable people will want to be part of the organization. Now, having mentioned that, let me cover just a little bit about how we actually do answer that reporter's question. How did we do what we did, which I think in some ways may be relevant to some of the other groups that are trying to do similar things. We do debate ideas. We stress balance in our programs. We try to get the best people we can on both sides. We are focused on debate being civil, serious, and high quality. Fair debates have been something of a hallmark for us, and it surprises me that more groups haven't copied that. Because when you do good debates, students are impressed. They think well of the organization that's hosting them. The debates attract more people to meetings than would otherwise come. They attract people who don't necessarily agree with you. They give you a chance to persuade others. They train people to address ideas that differ from theirs. They train our people to see how, federal society members to see how to respond to other ideas. They train other students to see how to respond to ideas they haven't heard before from some of the speakers we bring in for the debates. Our classic mode is to bring in an outside speaker to debate one of the professors on campus. That has been a very, very useful way to getting ideas heard that otherwise there'd be relatively less sympathy with in the academy, in the law schools. And students, it helps all students with their education. And I'd like to say the law schools should be paying us for providing this kind of service. Somehow I don't think that's quite the way it's going to work. But they are getting ideas, we're getting out the ideas, getting them discussed in a way that really benefits those law students. Now, I will say the final thing I'll say on that point is quality is the key to making this work. If you have a debate and it's fair and it's well done and you have good people, you have people on both sides and it's a fair discussion, but neither one has anything terribly sharp to say, it's not going to do anything for you. So at the end of the day, you also have to have high quality debates or the rest of it becomes useless. We've operated with a structure from early on. It's kind of almost a pipeline. We get people involved as law students. Then we try to, with the interest they have in ideas, we try to keep them involved as they go into law school, as they go into in practicing lawyers. We get them involved in our practice groups. We have 15 practice groups divided by area of legal practice. We have 65 city chapters around the country. And then having worked with us, having been involved in developing ideas, they go out and they often do some things on their own in terms of getting involved in public policy. And some of the things they'll want to discuss we can continue to do. Some of them may be direct advocacy, may even be things that 501c3s can't do at all. That's fine. That's a welcome byproduct of what we do. The essence of what we do is about the ideas. That's what helps build up this informal network, which can really add a great deal to the public policy discussion. For people, in terms of how this works for the people involved, for students, we have been somewhat bottom up, which I think has been extremely important to being successful. We have for example, at Harvard Law School, we have about 20% of the Harvard Law School student body on our email list. We are clearly the strongest extracurricular group at that law school and in a majority of the top 20 law schools. And students, and I think of many, many other law schools around the country, I have chapters of Ed Senate, all 200 accredited law schools. And our students, I think, get involved for and stay involved for a number of reasons. One is they feel ownership. They feel they are really running the chapters. They are choosing the speakers. They have broad outlines they need to follow. But they are the ones who are basically making most of the day-to-day decisions. They have to stick to a civil tone and serious discussion of ideas, but we give them a lot of latitude in how they conduct their programs. We develop a lot of friendships, not only within the chapters, but also we have a national student symposium. People come to that. They meet each other. I constantly see lifelong friendships being made there in such a way that the students, have something to draw on as they proceed with their legal careers when they get interested in X issue or Y issue. They know other people who share those issues. So the informal type of network that develops is extremely important. And another thing that I think has been very helpful to us is focusing on mission. And that's sort of business 101. But I think we've done a good job of that substantively. I also think we've done a good job of it in terms of personnel. I've been at the Federal Society for 28 years, and Leonard Leo has been at the Federal Society for our executive vice president for 20 years. You don't have to be there that long. But you do need some significant degree of continuity in your key personnel to make some of these entrepreneurial efforts effective and worthwhile. And the other thing I'd stress is people. The people involved are going to be key, not only in terms of the organization, but the people you attract to run your chapters, to run your efforts. The more, and it's a circular thing, the more good people you get, the more good people will become involved. Going back to this sort of pipeline starting with law students, we now have about 45,000 people involved in the Federal Society. Totally, we've got about 4,500 really active volunteers running our events. We run 1,300 events a year in law school, which is about an average of six meetings per law school, and many of them, it's more than that. So we'll really be able to provide something of a significant additional set of ideas for students to consider. The final thing I'd say is at the end of the day, there has to be something valuable as the goal to make an organization work. It's fine to have good structures, but for us, that is that the American Constitution has been the best humans have found to help secure freedom. Law affects everything. Now, once the rule of law is established, you've done a lot of the good you can do through law. When you try to do other things, when you try, rather than making a rule of law rather than rule of men, when you try to start controlling every aspect of life through law, you are much more likely to get in the way of solutions than you are to come up with them. Now, our aim in general has been, as I said, to get good people involved who play their role in public policy discussion at every level. And I'm looking forward to hearing from my fellow panelists who, through their entrepreneurial efforts, are seeking to do the same thing in their areas. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gene, and congratulations to you, to Leo, to everybody involved in terms of what you have done and what you've accomplished. I know from past conversations with Sally, what you are trying to do is you look at medical education, too. So over to you.
Thank you. Let's see. So I didn't need to have my daily Starbucks this morning because at 4:30 this morning I participated in a video conference which was taking place in Washington put on by the International Women's Forum. I thought it was the Independent Women's Forum, but it wasn't. And so 700 women from 40 countries, and the panel was four of us. And it wasn't what Gene would call fair and balanced. It was me here in Phoenix versus Uwe Reinhardt from Princeton, a woman from the Ministry of Health in Paris, France, and an academic doctor from Japan. And the moderator, of course, was the head of the Community Foundation of Boulder, Colorado. So I have not had to have a coffee today, But, boy, that was a start to my morning. So I'm glad you're all here, and I hope it's a slightly friendlier audience. Because all of the venom was against me, not against anyone else. So I am the intellectual progenitor of the Benjamin Rush Society, and as Ed said, a Federalist Society-type organization for medical students, residents, fellows, and ultimately doctors. It never ceases to amaze me how time flies. Gene has been at the Federalist Society for 28 years. I've been heading up PRI for 20 years. I got in my car on September 30th, 1991, drove to San Francisco to take over PRI, and it has been a challenge, but it's been a great, as John Podhoretz would say, it's been a hell of a ride. One of the reasons I took the opportunity was, of course, to get out of the Canadian healthcare system, which had been taken over by the government. So you had long waiting lists that had happened, ration care, and lack of access to the latest treatments and procedures. So it was a great opportunity for me to come to America. For those of you who know me, I've been involved in the healthcare debate ever since I arrived. It started with Hillary Care, California Single Payer Initiative, Romney Care, and then, of course, Obamacare. My goal in life is to achieve affordable, accessible, quality care for all Americans, but not by increasing the role of government in our healthcare system. So you're probably wondering, why am I talking about this when I'm here to talk about the Benjamin Rush Society? Well, it goes without saying that saving our healthcare system has a lot to do with our medical students. In 2006, my godson, who was from Canada, had started at Columbia Medical School. His father had been a doctor in Vancouver, Canada, and a good friend of mine. At age 40, he quit being a doctor. He had to see 55 to 60 patients a day. He had a global budget, which was used up in November. He had no more money to treat his patients. And his salary was set by the provincial government. So when Lockie said, "Dad, I want to become a doctor just like you were," his dad said, "Well, you better go to the United States because you don't want to practice medicine in Canada with its Medicare for All system." I go to New York a lot on business, so I would get together with Lockie for dinner. I'd take him out to nice places, and he'd buy the largest steak on the menu, and I'd be going, "How am I going to pay for this?" But anyway, we always had very frank conversations. He said one evening, "It is odd that all of my professors at the Columbia Medical School, all of the teaching docs in the hospitals that I work at, they continually say, we need the government to take over our healthcare system. It would be cheaper and it would be more efficient." And Lockie knew that this was not true because of his experience with his dad. And then he started to think, why am I in medicine? I mean, this looks like it's going to be a disaster. So, of course, I got extremely agitated by this and thought, I've got to do something. But what should I do? So I thought about Gene and his wonderful Federal Society and what a fabulous job he'd done. I thought, maybe the Federal Society for Law Students could be duplicated for medical students. So it was a year before I bumped into Gene at the Brent Bozell's Accuracy and Media Conference, and we chatted about it. And he said, "I think it's a really good idea, but it won't be easy." And I thought, well, nothing in life is easy, but nothing ventured, nothing gained, and no one loves a challenge more than I do, as many of you know from my healthcare work. So it took about 2 years to kind of get together, and fortunately, the Kauffman Foundation provided a seed grant for us to do an exploratory meeting in May 2008. We got some docs together, Scott Gottlieb from AEI, Gene was our key, Mark Schiller, a psychiatrist in San Francisco, DeRoy Murdoch from the Atlas Foundation. We had about 20 people. We spent the whole day talking about this. The excitement was unbelievable. But, of course, that's one day, but I've got to move this whole thing forward. My husband, many of you know, is Charles Kessler, and he's a lot smarter than I am. And when he loved the idea, and he said, "You should call it the Benjamin Rush Society." And I thought, the Benjamin Rush Society? I already knew who Benjamin Rush was. So, but I thought, well, we'll think about that. At the meeting, DeRoy Murdoch said, "I've done an investigation. We should call it the Benjamin Rush Society." So, and of course, Benjamin Rush was one of our founders, and he was a medical doctor and one who also believed in leeching, but that was back then. So my friend David Greitzer, who works at the Manhattan Institute, is always saying, "Sally, you know, Benjamin Rush believed in using leeches." I said, "David, that was way back then." Anyway, today, now we have John Graham, who is our Director of Healthcare Studies, is the head of the Benjamin Rush Society. We have a board of advisors and a board of visitors. The advisors are people like Jean, like Grace Marie Turner, Bridget Wagner at Heritage. We sort of do the strategy work for BRS. Our board of visitors is comprised of doctors, like Scott Gottlieb and my young friend, Dr. Jason Fodeman, who I met through Heritage. He was an intern there. He's now finalizing his residency at Cedars-Sinai in L.A. He's written op-eds that have appeared in the paper. He's done speeches. He participates in the debate. So thank you, Ed, for that. Great ideas are always stolen.
You're here.
So BRS partners with medical students to establish chapters at medical schools. We have about 20 chapters now, from Harvard to Duke, from George Washington to Texas A&M. We want to expose medical students to an alternative vision of how we can achieve universal coverage and affordable, accessible, quality health care. The centerpiece, of course, is debates, Oxford-style debates, where we bring in the physicians who are visitors and some others, and then we focus on both sides of the aisle. Now, what we do is we have handheld devices to measure, to do a pre-vote and a post-vote. Now, this may have come as a surprise to you, but I guess it wasn't a surprise to me. In the pre-vote tallies, about 65% of these medical students would be in support of the proposition that the universal coverage is the responsibility of the federal government. 65%. The good news is, after the debates, and we've presented our side of the story, about 60% are still in favor of the government being in charge of our health care. But it goes back to what Lockie said, they don't know anything else because that's what they're taught. But a number of students come up after and say, you know, I've never heard these ideas, I really want to think about them, and I'd like to get involved. So it is encouraging, but it is a depressing statistic. So we want to champion the idea that healthcare decisions should be the responsibility of doctors and patients and not the government. With 49% of graduating residents, people like Dr. Jason Fodeman, are now joining hospitals and not going in to private practice. These are the people that are the future of our medicine, and it is so important that we keep the world's finest healthcare system alive and well. We're very active in social media. This is beyond my pay grade, but the young people and the docs all do Twitter, they do Facebook, they do Google groups, and of course we have our own website. But we have to continue to allow doctors and patients to freely practice medicine. Otherwise, will the best and the brightest go into medicine? Will the best and brightest who are doctors now continue as doctors? You know, Canadians have an escape valve. I said this to Uwe Reinhardt this morning. One of the reasons that Canadians, you know, aren't as upset as they might be, a lot of them come to the United States. 44,000 every year come to this country and pay out of pocket for health care that they find they're on a waiting list in Canada. So I was fortunate to have the opportunity to move to the U.S. on a permanent basis. I'm now an American citizen. But I ask, where will the best doctors go and where will we as patients go if we have a government takeover of our healthcare system? As my mentor Milton Friedman used to quip, one step forward and two steps back. Not what we usually think, two steps forward. One step forward, two steps back. That's the way we advance. And it's very true with the Benjamin Rush Society as well. There is a term in economics called the infant industry argument, and at some point, the infant needs to get off the parent's payroll and take care of itself. And my idea is the Benjamin Rush Society needs to be a standalone organization. It shouldn't be part of PRI, just like the Federal Society isn't part of any other organization. So as soon as we can get the funding secure, then we're going to spin it off. Now, my godson, Lockie, is in his sixth year of orthopedic surgery at UCLA. He actually was the doctor who treated Nancy Reagan when she had her fractured pelvis. He's got a great career ahead of him. But he's going, what am I doing? I've spent 31 years of my life in school. So, we've got a huge task ahead. It's not easy, as Jean said, but it's so very important. So thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions.
Thanks very much, Sally. And I was remiss in not mentioning your day job at Pacific Research Institute, where you do such fantastic work. Mitch, what's going on in national security?
Okay. Well, let me also thank Joe Kwong and Adam Meyerson for the invitation to speak. It's a privilege to pay tribute to a great organization like the Federalist Society, and I'm all the more pleased to be doing it at the meeting of another great organization. All right, so what is the problem? Why is an organization based on the Federalist model an essential part of the solution? And perhaps most important, how can we best follow the path cut for us by the Federalists? Well, the problem is easy to stage. Our foreign economic and national security policy is at a point of extraordinary intellectual exhaustion, just as the law was in 1982 when the Federalist Society was founded. And the potential consequence is equally severe. The Yale historian John Lewis Gaddis tells a story that he believes is a perfect illustration of this exhaustion. Let me share it with you. The date was September 24th, 1998. A briefing team had invited itself to Yale to make the case for the Clinton administration's policy of expanding the NATO alliance eastward. There would be no problem about including the Czechs, the Poles, the Hungarians, the briefers told us, because so much effort had gone into reorganizing committees in Brussels to make them feel welcome. The briefing concluded after about half an hour, and questions were called for. Our colleague Bruce Russett raised his hand and asked whether NATO expansion might not cause difficulties with the Russians, perhaps undermining President Yeltsin's efforts to democratize the country, perhaps creating an awkward situation for the new or prospective members of the alliance as Russian power revived. Perhaps even driving Russia into some new form of cooperation with the Chinese, thereby reversing one of the greatest victories in the Cold War, the Sino-Soviet split. There was a moment of shocked silence. Then one of the briefers exclaimed in front of the entire audience, "Good God, we never thought of that."
Well.
Now, Gaddis' conclusion is sobering. It seems fair, he said, looking back on the years since the Cold War, to apply the Ronald Reagan test. Is the United States better off in 2009 than we were in 1989? I don't think so. So how has this happened? Well, earlier this year, Roger Hertog, one of the founding supporters of the Hamilton Society, spoke at another meeting of the Philanthropy Roundtable, and he answered this question, how, rather sharply. Think back to the 1940s, 1950s, and even early 1960s, when an extraordinary group of thinkers were at the height of their powers. These were the intellectual heavyweights whose insights guided the United States as it challenged the Soviet Union and won the Cold War. No comparable group exists today because our universities no longer see themselves as training our best and brightest in the art and science of diplomacy. And what you don't know can kill you. So, can the Federalist model help us avoid killing ourselves? Well, I'd like to reflect with you on what I see as four key features of the Federalist approach, which I believe other organizations can successfully make their own. The first is the Federalist's focus on students. Now, Roger is not alone, of course, in tracing the condition of our foreign economic and security policy thinking to the intellectual environment at our universities. But it is not only that the university is the source of the problem. It is also, paradoxically, a final opportunity to address the problem. Henry Kissinger wrote in his memoirs that the convictions that leaders have formed before reaching office are the intellectual capital they will consume as long as they continue in office. There is little time for leaders to reflect. They are locked in an endless battle in which the urgent constantly gains on the important.
He stole it.
Sorry, Ed.
Oh.
Well, whoever said this.
The urgent overwhelms the important.
I think this can be said, actually, of all competent professionals at whatever stage of their career. So reaching students offers the best and often the last chance to substantially influence their thinking or to strengthen their conviction. Second, the Federalists focus on building friendships. Now, the Federalists spend the bulk of their budget on events. But even if the Federalist Society never held another event after today, the network it has built would continue to influence the law for many years. On the other hand, if the Federalist Society had not built a genuine community, what one of its founders calls a university without walls, no number of events would suffice to make it so fruitful. But friendship usually cannot be achieved directly. It has to come from the deep culture of the organization. And I believe the Federalists live this spirit of friendship in several important ways. First, the national leadership sees itself as helping students to exercise their own initiative more effectively. They are mentors ready to assist, not masterminds looking for assistance. Second, the Federalist Society insists on cordiality toward those who may oppose its principles, even those who may oppose its existence. And much of what the Federalists have achieved, I think, could likely be traced to their genuine spirit of engagement. Third, the Federalist Society inspires friendships within the organization. And this is a more significant achievement than many may suppose. Promoting constructive debate within a certain school of thought and fostering the professional development of younger members has been just as important as engaging opponents. And finally, as I can personally attest, the Federalists are unfailingly generous with other organizations. And frankly, I attribute most of the Hamilton Society's progress so far to our attempt to build this same culture of friendship. In only 12 months, we have gone from startup to nearly 30 chapters. And our typical chapter is ranked in the top 2% of American universities. Last year, our chapters sponsored 45 events. And as this academic year starts, they're on track to double that number. And these events regularly attract 50 to 100 students. Just last week, our Williams College chapter held a debate that was attended by 7% of the entire student body. And I received a note from a couple of days ago from a senior faculty member who participated in the debate, and he said, "The air was electric with excitement. Questions were hard but respectful. This truly was an exceptional event." And I'm happy to report this hasn't been an uncommon reaction. So, a focus on students and a focus on friendship. I think the third important feature is focus, period. Steve Jobs was known not only for killing bad products at Apple, but killing most of the good ones as well. And the Federalists, like any successful organization, have had numerous opportunities to expand their mission. But they have recognized that most of these should be refused. And one of the Federalist Society's founders put it this way. "The reason we've succeeded is that the people who ran the Federalist Society 20 years ago and who will run it 20 years from now, all have a very clear vision of what the organization should do, which is promote ideas. And if anybody tries to move the focus of the organization, they're going to run into a brick wall immediately." Finally, the Federalists have, from the beginning, forged partnerships with investor philanthropists, people like you. Some in the media took the 2005 confirmation of John Roberts as Chief Justice to be proof that the Federalist Society had arrived. If that judgment is correct, it took them 23 years. Now, be that as it may, the work of organizations like the ones represented on this panel, which is a mission not merely to resist, but to transform, is without a doubt the work of a generation, and it demands the patience of a great investor. And as important as it is for us to form leaders with a vision for the future, we will not accomplish this mission without philanthropists who have vision right now. And I believe this is one reason Roger Hertog argues that supporting national security studies is a patriotic act. I think he means not only that it's good for the country, but that like all patriots, benefactors of organizations like ours know that the full fruits of their sacrifice may be years in coming. John Adams wrote that posterity will never know how much it cost the present generation to preserve its freedom. So I think philanthropy like this takes real courage. I'll conclude with a more hopeful story than the one I started with. Last spring, our University of Virginia chapter held a debate on China between Aaron Friedberg, one of our founders, and the dean of UVA's Public Policy School. After the debate, Aaron was approached by a young man who looked to be out of central casting for the child of hippies. He had dreadlocks, tie-dyed garb, and his name, this is not a joke, is River. Now, it was clear this was the first time River had ever encountered anything outside a very narrow range of thought. And he admitted having experienced a kind of awakening listening to Aaron. So will River one day be Secretary of State? Well, we can't know that, of course, but here's what we do know. We know that River, however strong his previous convictions, is now part of the Hamilton community. We know that Hamilton won't miss an opportunity to assist him in developing his mind and his career. We know that there are many Rivers out there, all with the potential to do important things, and some of them great things for our country. And we know that it has fallen to us here today to seek them, to find them, to prepare them. Thank you.
In a footnote, I should add that I'm very grateful personally to Mitch because he was a publisher of one of my books about 10 years ago when he was at Spence Publishing. But Mitch, that's a very exciting story you tell about the Alexander Hamilton Society. Marilyn Fedak is from New York City. She's been extraordinarily successful in the investment profession. And she has taken on the challenge of the B schools. Marilyn, tell us about it.
Okay. So the Marilyn Fedak Capitalism Project, and by the way, I always feel slightly guilty that I named it after myself, but so did many of you name your projects after yourself. So thank you so much. You made me feel much better. It came out of an epiphany that I had in the winter of 2009, and I'm sure that you all remember that horrible period. The economy had stopped dead in its tracks. The financial markets were barely functioning. And, of course, all the usual suspects had seized upon this crisis to demonize capitalism. Now, I have seen not only in my career in business, but in my personal life, the benefits of capitalism up close and personal. So I said to myself, like Sally said to herself, well, what can I do here? What can I do to defend our free markets? Now, at the same time, 40 years in the investment business, I've met with lots of young people. And I realized there had been a transition, that young people had become very cynical about capitalism. Yeah, they were coming into the investment business. Yes, they wanted to make a lot of money. But that wasn't their passion, their goal. They didn't think there was any good in that. They just wanted to make the money and move on to something that was more meaningful. And I realized, having spoken to them over those years, that I thought that a lot of the reason for this was that they were not being exposed in their academic studies to a really unbiased exposure to capitalism versus other market systems. And I think the key here is exposure, as many people have pointed out, not to proselytize. Oh, can you hear me? Okay, thank you. Usually people don't complain that I speak too softly. Quite the opposite, ask my husband. Okay, so I decided that my mission would be to bring these two trends together, to try and get colleges and universities to expose their students to the moral and philosophical underpinnings of capitalism. Now, for about a year, I kind of explored this idea, and I spoke to many people, quite a few of whom are here at this conference today. And at the end of that time, I decided that I wanted to partner in this project with the Center for the American University at the Manhattan Institute. And Jim Pearson happens to be in the back of the room. He wasn't going to come to this session, but when I told him that I was going to mention him, he decided to come. It's one of the ways I've drummed up support here. And the reason was because that I really felt that I could move the project together much more efficiently by this partnering. The Center for the American University had the infrastructure. They understood the structure of academia, which I really don't. They had the contacts. And I couldn't be happier. and the Adam Smith Society, which is trying to bring a free market exposure to business schools, is our first major project. So first of all, why did we decide on this methodology for Adam Smith? Why did we decide to use the Federalist model? And the primary reason is that not only has it been very effective, but we thought that it was very leverageable and impactful. Now, originally, Jim and I and others had thought that we would actually do this at the undergraduate level. And we realized pretty quickly that was going to be very hard to do, to get curriculums changed, and very expensive. So we thought that we could get more bang for the buck by starting out this way. Now, we haven't abandoned undergraduate. We have some ideas there, too, but we want to start with Adam Smith. And secondly, as with all these other groups that we're talking about, by going directly to business schools, we thought that we would hit a group of people who were likely to be very important in the next generation of leadership in our society. So the question that people always ask me when I tell them what I'm doing is, well, business schools, what a waste of time. Aren't business schools naturally in favor of the free markets and capitalism? Ha. I think, you know, if you ask most faculty and students, they would say, oh, yes, of course we are. But the reality is a lot more nuanced than that. So let me give you some examples. I have now read a number of case studies at the Harvard Business School. Some of these case studies start with the implicit, in fact, explicit assumption that there is man-made global warming. It isn't a question, it isn't a debate, it is assumed. Or, for example, that diversity on a very narrowly defined, statistically based basis is better than a free meritocracy. Let me give you another example. I went to Harvard Business School. I don't know if others in the room have, but when I read my alumni magazine, oh my God, I feel like I'm reading the Columbia School of Social Work. You look at the front cover, and it drives me crazy every quarter. It's all about sustainability, giving back, NGOs, diversity, income redistribution. Swear to God, the last two issues have highlighted income redistribution. Now, there's nothing wrong with these things. In fact, you know, at the last session we talked about, it's great that young people today are getting interested in ways of improving our society earlier. But what about job creation? What about, you know, assessing how many minutes? I can't see it. 1 minute? 2 minutes? Okay, I'll just talk very quickly. Okay. How about building assets to be able to donate to fund such things? And importantly, even where there is support for the free markets, it tends to be very pragmatic. It is about job creation, personal growth. There is a lack of understanding about the critical role that the free markets play in ensuring our liberty, our rights, the well-being of our populace. This is what we need young people to understand. And this is what the viewpoint that we're trying to bring to campus. Now, our effort was greatly facilitated by Gene Meyer. I was thinking of starting a group called Friends of Gene, but then I realized the acronym would be FOG. Yeah. I didn't think that was the right image we were trying to project, so I'll come up with something better. He was extraordinarily generous with his time and his guidance, and most importantly, he introduced us to a young man at Harvard Business School who had formed the basis for a similar idea at HBS. We hooked up with this young man, and we have now launched our first chapter at the Harvard Business School. We have chapters that we think will launch soon at Yale and at Columbia. We have many other student groups that are interested in this, but right now, frankly, I'm the only donor. So we really need partners, and I was given dispensation to say this. I was told I could say this. If you went to business school, and you would like us to consider starting a chapter at your alma mater, please let me know. If you're interested in ensuring that these kinds of ideas, that the importance of free markets to our society is imbued in the next generation of leaders, please let me know. I hope you will join us in building this out. Thank you very much.
We're open to questions. Let me throw the first one out. We talked about this for a minute before we sat down. Gene, did the biases of the American Bar Association, or Sally, the biases of the American Medical Association, were they factors? But what I heard from all four of you, it was really just kind of the general academic milieu into which the different professional schools have fallen. What do you think?
Well, I think it was more of the general tone of things. I think in our case, the American Bar Association was just one example of the general tone and the lack of interest in the type of ideas we wanted to discuss and talk about. It was also a little confusing in our case because you have the same thing with the American Medical Association. The American Bar Association was at the time we started thought to be conservative. I remember writing to one donor who said something in a proposal and said, well, I thought the American Bar Association was conservative, and I basically listed the positions they were taking, and he took the point. I think the same is probably true of the AMA, right?
Absolutely. And I agree with Gene. I never even thought about the AMA when I was meeting with Lockheed, but as I started thinking more about it, more and more people would say, well, the American Medical Association represents all doctors and, of course, a lot of medical students and the rest. But in truth, the fact, the American Medical Association has become so political over the last several years, it only represents 17% of doctors, and that number is declining. And fortunately, we've seen some startups to the AMA that are competing, Docs for Patient Care, which won the Salvatore Award at the Resource Bank, and the American Associations of Physicians and Surgeons. So there are some groups starting up, but definitely the AMA is not helpful to young students, and this young Jason Fodeman and all of his friends would never join the AMA. So we need alternate groups.
Thank you. Thank you both. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking our panel for a wonderful day.